With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, my name's Stuart Miles, and welcome to the Apocalypse Podcast. Apple's WWDC Developer Conference keynote revealed a swathe of new features for iPhone, iPad, Apple Watch, Apple TV, and Mac, as well as the future roadmap for the company's computers. And here we are at the end of the conference, keen to talk about how those changes will affect Apple's main devices, and also the plethora of other gadgets, like the HomePod and AirPods 2. And that's before we even consider the big announcement of the week, Apple's confirmation that it will be building its own processors for the Mac going forward. To join me to discuss the big announcements at the event, I'm joined by Apocalypse editor Chris Hall and Apocalypse associate editor Dan Grabham. So I'm going to start with you, Dan. Let's talk about iOS and iPadOS. What do we think about widgets?
Well, yeah, widgets were quite unexpected, really, as a new feature for iOS, because Apple has been so obsessed for so long about keeping its home screen in the same kind of format. It has experimented with a few widgety type things before on the Today view and also in iPadOS as well. But yeah, it was quite unexpected, and really it's similar to widgets that we've seen before on Android and indeed Windows Phone. A lot of people on Twitter were talking about the fact that, you know, we've seen several of the examples that were shown by Apple on Windows Phone devices before, because you can reformat the widgets in sort of various ways in terms of taking up the space that, say, four app icons do. So that was quite interesting. And also there was also App Library, which is basically like the app drawer on Android, a place to store all your app icons. And you can hide some of the home screens on iOS. It's basically the biggest change to the iPhone home screen since it was launched in 2007. So there's obviously, you know, quite a lot of interest in it, but also quite a lot of people saying, well, why didn't we have it before?
Now, Chris, you're a big Android user. You use iPhone occasionally, but a big Android user. And I get the feeling from your silence so far that you've kind of seen this all before.
Well, there's sort of an amusing sense that, yeah, some of this stuff has been seen before. When Android launched its first device, some of these features were in place. In fact, you know, it had widgets, it had a classic clock on it, and that was in 2008, so only a year after the first iPhone had come out. Mm. And as an Android user, I have looked at the iPhone since its launch all the way up to now and thought, well, this always looks the same. Yeah, the device is a slightly different shape, but the home screen has essentially been the same thing. And one of the things that has always drawn me to Android is that you can pick up one of many different devices and it'll be the same use, but it'll be a totally different design and a totally different layout and the freedom to move that stuff around. Now, bringing that change over to iOS, adding these widgets, you know, being able to organize your apps away from just folders or icons on the home screen, to me makes it a lot more appealing. Suddenly, for me, I'm looking at the iPhone now and thinking, this actually looks a lot more interesting than it did just a couple of days ago, because it feels like there's more flexibility and customization coming down the line. One of the other things that has also changed that we haven't mentioned is that you'll be able to select your default app for, I think it's the browser and for email. And again, yeah, that means that there's going to be a little bit more flexibility in how you use your device. I know that it won't apply to everything. So sometimes you'll click on a link and it will open the Apple default app. But in some cases, you're going to get much more flexibility to manage the way that your device works. And I think that's a good thing.
I think that on the browzer stuff and the certainly the email stuff, I think it's going to be a big appeal to enterprise customers, because they'll be able to come in and say, right, you're going to get Microsoft Outlook. It's the same. We know how that works. That's the same protocol across the entire business. And we won't get those annoying calls to IT support saying, how do I set up mail in the iPhone or what have you? I think widgets, to me, it was one of those things where as soon as it was announced, I thought, I've seen this before, and it wasn't through the widgets on Android and the wonder of, as you mentioned, the G1 from all those years ago, yeah, but it was Windows Phone. And I was a big fan of Windows Phone when it first launched and loved the kind of those tiles, as they call them, the interactive tiles. And I think that will certainly be, as I say, quite appealing to people if they can work out how to use and get the most out of them. At the moment, I don't know about you, Dan, with whenever I need to check my activity stats on the phone, I swipe to the right and therefore reveal that panel of widgets just off the homepage and get access to my, you know, to see what the basic stats there are there from there, rather than go off and find the app itself buried somewhere in a folder on page 28 or something. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the weather, for example, is a bit of a no-brainer, isn't it? Because you want to be able to see at a glance, really. And the problem with that sort of the today view on iOS as now is you end up with quite a long list of widgets. So you might have, you might want to go and look at battery life of your AirPods or something, and it's way down. But in fact, you will be able to bring that to the fore. So I think it's just going to add more customization options that people have wanted for a long time. You know, in terms of we were talking about the email client, you know, Outlook, like as you mentioned, apps very compelling, and because it's actually a really good app on iOS. Also, I think Chrome. You know, so many people use Chrome, and I think that is. I don't have a problem using Safari on my iPhone. I've got used to it, but actually, one of the key features I find on Chrome these days is the saving of passwords, because, you know, we've all got so many passwords, and the password manager on Chrome is actually really good now. And being able to bring that into the iOS experience in a more seamless way is brilliant, to be honest.
Now, you might not realize this, but you've obviously, if you're an iPhone user, you've already had interactive widgets on your home screen for a long time. I've just remembered a wonderful joy is that if you look at the clock icon, it actually is the real time and it moves. The second hand is always moving. So it will be like that. And there we go. So moving on to iPad OS. For me, the big news here is Scribble stuff. Do you want to tell us more, Dan?
Yeah, so Scribble is basically for handwriting recognition, and it should be able to put it into most fields. We don't quite know how flexible it's going to be at the moment. But you'd be able to put it in the search bar or really write on places that you haven't been able to before, and that's actually going to be quite compelling, I think, because a lot of people are using Apple Pencil, but they still need to get the keyboard up to do a lot of text input, unless they've got a separate Bluetooth keyboard or whatever. So it is actually going to bring that experience a lot better. And in fact, you know, we talked about iOS and Windows Phone. This is straight out of the Surface playbook, really. And, you know, we've seen a lot of action around Windows Ink on Windows 10. And, you know, this is sort of an extension of that, really. So it's making the iPad differentiated from the iPhone experience and really giving people another feature that says, OK, well, you can use this for anything now.
Yeah, it feels like it's giving more purpose to the pencil as well, in that sense of if you buy a pencil, you don't just have to be able to draw. You can now use it to make notes and enter things in and all those stuff. Chris, is there anything that caught your eye with iPadOS?
Not a huge amount, to be honest. Although Universal Search is obviously useful for everybody. Universal Search, I remember Universal Search back on BlackBerry in the good old days. Just being able to get to everything you need through search is fantastic because it saves time messing around, opening up, you know, swiping through pages, looking for things. So being able to search for everything through a single search bar is obviously going to be a real time-saving advantage.
I think, I mean, that's to me, that felt identical to Spotlight in macOS. Is that something you find yourself using? And therefore, do you think if you had an iPad, you know, if you were using a power user on the iPad, you'd use that in the same way?
Yeah, I am a big fan of Spotlight. I use it for everything, even things that you wouldn't think of. So I use it for calculations and stuff like that, just because it is so dynamic. Search bars have changed so much over the past few years that they literally went from local searches to online searches, and then they sort of became universal, and people started introducing things like the awesome bar and power bars and all the rest of it. Google search bars on Android are very similar, that they will search across a wide range of things. And sometimes you'll be surprised with the things that they actually manage to find and do. Often you don't need to go to a page when you've got a search bar that will do everything for you. Spotlight is the same. Obviously, that has expanded its functionality over the past 3 or 4 years. And it's good to see that moving over to the iPad as well.
So quick to round up the iOS and iPadOS, do we think what they're doing is good? I know we haven't talked about a lot of things like apps library and app clips and all the other things that you can put app in the front of and stuff like that. But overall, do you think people are going to be excited by it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's quite a good update, actually. It's just a shame that we didn't get some of these features before. I mean, you mentioned app clips there. That's going to be really handy. It's that they're kind of... you know, when you go to a car park and you go and you see you've got a paid to park, but you need to download the app, you're going to be able to just scan a code. It could be a QR code. It could be one of Apple's special codes. And it will bring up an app clip on your phone and you can basically pay there and then without having to go through the process, going to the app store, downloading the app and that kind of thing. So that's actually been really useful. So there's some really cool stuff in the update. And I think App Library is going to sort people's home screens out, which it, you know, needs doing. I've got 8 screens on my phone that are just full of apps that, you know, I gave up trying to sort long ago. And, you know, as we mentioned about Spotlight search, that's how I search on for my apps on the iPhone. I just search for them like I would on the Mac. So, yeah, I think they're really good updates, actually.
Still to come, we talk about the impact moving to Apple Silicon will have for the Mac business.
I'm definitely excited about there being a ARM-based Mac because I think, you know, having... And if that does come before the end of the year, that is thrilling to me, really, be able to take it out and about and actually have a more iPad-like experience, but also with the sort of Mac keyboard.
Okay, so we're back. Apple Watch, TV OS, HomePod, AirPod with spatial audio, and plenty of other things. When it comes to the big announcements from the week, Chris, that weren't sort of focused around the core business, as I'd like to call it, of, you know, iPhone, iPad, Mac OS. What really caught your eye?
Sleep tracking definitely caught my eye. We've been talking about sleep tracking for a long time. We've been talking about the lack of native support for it in the Apple Watch when lots of other people have been talking about it, Fitbit, Garmin, Polar. Basically, all of the wearables have offered some form of sleep tracking. And it's very interesting that it's coming to Watch OS. Of course, a lot of people have said or have been saying for some time that it's not in there because most people charge their watch overnight, because generally that's it. You wear it during the day, you charge it overnight, you put it back on in the morning. So exactly when you're supposed to charge your watch, I don't know if you're going to be trying to track your sleep all the way through the night. But the good thing about sleep tracking is that it completes the picture of what's going on with your body. So whilst your Apple Watch is measuring all of these other things, your heart rate and your steps and your movement and how you're standing up and exercise and all the rest of it, sleep is the most important part, really, because sleep is the recovery. So from a fitness point of view, it is going to sleep that's actually making you you stronger. You do the exercise to break yourself down, you go to sleep to build yourself back up again. And sleep is so important for combating stress and being productive at work and all of those sorts of things. So I think it's a very important metric to be included. I can't wait to see it working and give it a go and see how exactly all pans out. But the question of how you're going to charge your device or when you're going to charge your device still remains for me.
Yeah, I mean, on the practical side, I mean, I charged my Apple Watch overnight generally, but last night I forgot to charge it because I came to bed late. I just went to sleep. So this morning I've done a workout and now it, you know, nearly 10 o'clock in the morning, it's telling me that, you know, I need to charge it and, you know, whatever else. So practically, I don't know how it's going to pan out, because unless you charge it during the evening, which actually generally I found I need to do some exercise or whatever to complete my rings, you know, unless you charge it during that time, I don't know how people's watches are going to last the next day. So, you know, they will last overnight, but they won't necessarily last the next day.
Yeah, I find that's the same thing. I get about 18 hours from it. So if you've gone out, if you've got up early, had a long day, done some exercise, you know, maybe a 5K run or something, by midnight, it's at 25-30%, which is fine because you feel like you've got some space there. But then if I'm then going to have to wear it overnight, It depends on, we haven't obviously worked out yet how much of a battery drain that is. I do suspect, though, but by 10 o'clock in the morning, the next day, you're going to be like, oh, okay, now what do I do? And then for those people that are really keen on the tracking of rings and, you know, completing their rings and all the other stuff, that, you know, that if I take it off now, I don't want to move because that's just wasted ring juice, whatever they call it. So it's be interesting to see that. I think the other sort of thing I thought that was beyond the core operating systems was HomePod now getting more control with HomeKit of lights and cameras and things like that, trying once again, every year we say this, Apple trying to get into the smart home space. Obviously, you know, Amazon is still, with Alexa, is still way out there. Google Assistant is still way out there. Apple are still thinking, how do we do this? That. But also, the other one, Chris, you could talk to more about this, is the car key stuff. I thought that was quite interesting. Using an iPhone on a Tesla is just, you know, you don't have to have the keys. It's just second to none. But the idea of the car keys, well, I'll let you tell more.
Well, this is really a case of Apple stealing a march, because digital car keys have been around, and you've just been talking about Tesla, and Tesla has its own app. And there's a number of manufacturers that are supporting digital keys where you would have to use the manufacturer's app. And the thing that we know about individual manufacturer apps is, let's say, they're not always the best. I've used quite a lot through the range of cars that I have reviewed, and the number of problems that I have run into with trying to get this to work and trying to get it to authenticate and trying to get these things to work smoothly through these individual apps is difficult. So for Apple to offer this as a native function, digital car key support, it is quite a big deal, because it's going to move us beyond having to have a car key, or in some cases having to use a separate app from a manufacturer, so that you get that seamless experience through your car. So you'll be able to watch your car, you'll be able to unlock your car door using your phone instead of using the key. It's going to be designed for cars that offer what they call keyless entry, where you don't have to touch anything, whether you actually have to wave your phone at the door or not, which we saw in the demo, we don't yet know. In some cases, you have to tap near a location, or you have to hold the key or phone near the car in a particular place. But in some, it's just a proximity thing. So you probably found with the Tesla app, you just have to be close to the car and you sort of walk towards it and it'll unlock and meet you. And that's the same with a lot of RFID style keys that are already in existence. But the other thing about this is that once you have a digital key, you have a lot more flexibility, because you don't need to give somebody the key to open the car. You know, if somebody wants to go and get something out of the car, you can do it all remotely. You'll be able to give people temporary access to your car so that they can get into it. And you may have seen some of this stuff in the past, where you can grant delivery drivers permission to open the boot of your car to put a package in there and stuff like that. And I suspect all of that stuff is going to come in the same kind of way. Being able to say to, you know, your brother or your cousin or whoever, oh yeah, my car is in this place, you can use it if you want to, here's a digital key, and you can send that over by iMessage and they can go to the car and get into your car and drive around. It creates so much flexibility, and it's exactly the sort of thing that we would expect in the digital world that we now live in.
Yeah, I thought car key was, you know, really interesting feature, actually, because they, you know, they sort of talked about auto obviously quite a bit before, but it was a quite interesting side project, really. I think AirPods Pro, that came out of nowhere, didn't it? The spatial audio stuff, and with the you know, automatic switching between devices as well. And the spatial audio stuff is going to, you know, track your head position so that it can deliver a sort of, you know, a 360 audio experience. And I sort of thought that was quite interesting as well. I don't know how you feel about it, Stu, being a regular AirPods user as well.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice idea. It kind of, when they mentioned it, kind of reminded me of Sony's Reality 360 audio stuff. Yeah. So it seems that a lot of people are doing the spatial audio work. We've got, say, Sony doing it. Dolby Atmos is kind of trying to do with, like, Sonos with the soundbar, where it's, you know, trying to create these spatial things. We've got to a point now where, whether it's headphones, speakers, or what have you, is kind of they've obviously found the key of tricking your brain into believing that audio is coming from somewhere else. And I think that will have a huge impact on not only watching movies and TV shows and things like that, but also for games and the like, when you're listening to, you know, whether it's your iPad or your iPhone or Apple TV. I've kind of recently started using my AirPod Pros on my Apple TV more in the evening, just because I was getting complaints from the kids of like, "Dad, we're trying to go to sleep. Your TV's too loud." And you know, there I am watching, you know, some sort of action movie late at night because I can't sleep because it's too hot or whatever. And you just, so I'll just put those in. If the sound is going to be even better than my speakers at home, then, you know, that's a win-win from that point of view. I think, interestingly, going back to the CarPlay before we move on to the next subject, but the car key stuff is, this also to me opens up a huge new industry of tying in, as Chris said, you know, this idea of, if my car's parked at home, can I then get the delivery driver to drop my Amazon parcel into the back of my car instead of just leaving it on my doorstep? What happens, you know, does that mean from an insurance point of view, it would then know who's driving because I've then signed in from that point of view? You know, there's, or if I lend my car, automatically my insurance would say, well, actually, we can see that the main key holder is this person on this drive, therefore you get the insurance, or you get the points if you've been caught speeding. So there's, I think there's a big opportunity there. And as usual, although there are a number of instances already available where you can get digital keys like Tesla and things like that, I think this is Apple trying to standardize the format, so to speak, but also open up, by doing so, opening up to loads more businesses and industries to be able to take advantage as well. Right, we're going to move on to the big kind of news now from the week, which is that Apple is effectively ditching Intel. Not immediately, I think it will take some time. And this came along with a complete update as well to macOS, moving from 10 point something to 11 for those developers that care, which is quite a big step, but also kind of a move from what most people perceive to be just a, well, we'll fix some of the bugs and we'll, you know, tidy some things up, but we won't have that big a show, to saying it's got a completely brand new interface and, oh yeah, it runs on our own processors. Dan, tell us more.
Yeah, so macOS 11 Big Sur, as it's going to be called, that really is a restart for macOS, isn't it? It's, you know, we've had macOS 10 or macOS X, as it was called, for the best part of 20 years now. And this really sort of kicks it into the next level. But of course, yes, the bigger news was the move to ARM-based processors that are very similar to the iPad and iPhone processors, but will obviously be beefed up, will obviously be, you know, custom designed for the Mac. And there's, you know, massive questions over everything with this. Apple positioned it as a sort of new beginning for the Mac. And I think that, you know, that's definitely true. But we don't, you know, really know anything about performance. Apple were very precise in what they said about performance, that it would have improved performance per watt,
which, yeah,
which is basically saying it will be extremely efficient, which we know where they can do because we've seen it in the iPad Pro, we've seen it elsewhere. The interesting point of it is for people that have got Macs already, I suppose, and are going, well, what's my next Mac going to be like? And part of that, of course, is the millions of users that use them for quite, you know, high power projects like editing movies and that kind of thing. You know, not you know, actual Hollywood movies, rather than, you know, editing your home movies. And
you put yourself down, Dan.
And I feel that at the performance end, we're still going to be seeing Intel chips inside Macs for a long time. You know, the Xeon processor, inside the Mac Pro aren't going to be replaced by ARM chips anytime soon. ARM chips are scalable to that level. You know, they are in supercomputers, but really, they're, you know, what we're going to see first, I think, is a MacBook Air level notebook. There have been some rumors that it might be MacBook Pro, but I'd be really surprised if they changed the MacBook Pro line completely to their own processors in a short space of time. That's going to be a longer term thing. I think, you know, if you've just been out to buy a £2,000 or £3,000 plus 16-inch MacBook Pro based on Intel chips, that's not going to be suddenly gone away. It's going to be Apple will produce more computers with Intel chips, and they've been quite clear about that. Although obviously they wanted to put the onus on their own hardware efforts in the last week.
I think it's obviously a lot of change coming down the line. And Mac OS has had quite a number of changes in the past few years anyway. And that's been a challenge for a number of developers or people who have invested in software in the past that then see that software is no longer supported. So over the past few generations, I've had to move one of my applications because one version wasn't supported, and then I upgraded again and found that it had to be 64-bit, 32-bit applications weren't supported anymore. And then I had to move again because a different version was needed. And it sometimes feels as though things are running very, very quickly, and it's not always apparent. If you're a user who has a standard range of apps that you use all the time, then a lot of these changes go past and you think, why is all this happening? All I'm seeing is things that don't work now that used to work before. And I think that's always the danger with some of these big changes. There's some exciting stuff in here, like the suggestion that you're going to be able to use iPad or iOS apps on the desktop. And for a long time, I've been wondering why we haven't seen more of this kind of stuff. There will be all sorts of questions that are raised about whether you can use an app that has been designed principally for touch if they're not going to support touch on the Mac. And so that's one of the questions that I have. Are they ever going to put touch on the Mac? And it does sort of continue to blur this line between where the iPad Pro sits and where the MacBook sits. And there has been this sort of hole around the entry-level MacBook position, which used to be a sort of £800, $800 that is standard. It was the plastic MacBook at one point. And that, I think that hole still sort of exists for people who want to buy a more affordable Apple computer but don't want to use an iPad because they need something solid that's going to last them for several years. I don't know if this is going to address that, but hopefully it will.
I think for me, it's that feeling that the Mac OS, and this is where it starts, the new redesign of Mac OS feels like a variant of iOS now. From what I've seen in the pictures and the demos they did on the keynote and all the other stuff. And I think going forward, Mac OS will become a kind of iPad OS style variant of that as the core architecture slowly sort of merges into the two. And they talk about this transition of 2 years from Intel processors to Apple Silicon, which is their own built processors. And I think that within 5 years, you'll get to this point where everything's moved over to Apple Silicon. Then the iPad suddenly becomes the entry level, the iPad Pro becomes the entry level MacBook. Those two devices effectively become the same thing. And it's because in reality, it's the iPad as, with all the functionality that it has, but with a keyboard in a MacBook shell. That's how I kind of see it. The idea being, and certainly if you put them on a desktop machine, you'll be able to get more power in it because you won't. I suspect the Apple Silicon that is we've seen at the moment, the Bionic, I think it's A13, isn't it? Z or A12Z now. I'm already getting ahead of myself. thinking it's September. The A12Z is one of those devices where I think that they probably are holding it back already because of the payoff between wanting the power and wanting the performance, in that sense of battery life and all the other stuff. If you can put a bigger battery in that you'd have in a MacBook, then you could probably crank up the speed capability, and that will get them so far. I think from a software perspective as well, just the industry as a whole has been generally pushing people towards subscription-based software. We're seeing that with Office 365. We're seeing that with Microsoft 365. Everything changes their name all the time now. We're seeing that with Adobe Creative Cloud. And therefore sometimes those people will just go, oh, okay, I'll just download the new version. I paid my £10 a month for it or whatever. Anyway, it felt interesting that the way they were talking about it, Intel wasn't really mentioned at all in the keynote in that sense. It wasn't, this is rubbish, we're moving to this. It's just, look at the new possibilities we can add with our Apple Silicon, effectively always on, better battery life, because then you'll start loading in FaceTime ID onto Macs, and it just kind of creates parity across the entire board.
Yeah, one of the things that that you just mentioned was Always On. I don't know if they explicitly talked about Always On or adding in, you know, connectivity that isn't there at the moment. But this is one of the things that I've always found interesting, is that we value connectivity in our smartphones, and everybody's using those all the time, but we've been quite slow to move that over to other platforms. There have been a couple of attempts. You know, there are some tablets that, obviously, I mean, you can get the iPad with the eSIM built in and those kind of things, but it's actually been a fairly slow transition, especially in things like laptops. We've seen a few examples, but they've never really gone anywhere. And I'm wondering if that is part of this game, if moving to having, you know, that type of built-in connectivity is going to be something that they're pursuing with this, because obviously the ARM based platforms are much better suited to those kind of things, and Intel has never really pursued that. So I'll be interested to see if that happens, but also if there's actually an appetite for that. The world is changing fairly quickly, and previously you might have said, well, people don't need to be connected but on every individual device through the mobile network, because they're going to be sitting in an office. But I kind of get the feeling at the moment that with so many people not sitting in offices, that the future might be very, very different, and having wider mobile connectivity on individual devices might really be in demand.
Yeah, I mean, we 5G, for example, you know, we've talked about there being a 5G iPad Pro. Well, who's to say that the first ARM-based Mac wouldn't be a 5G device as well? You know, it could be.
Ooh, exciting stuff.
That would be exciting, wouldn't it? And then, you know, there are numerous possibilities with this. We've outlined some of them, but it is exciting. We have seen Intel stagnate a little bit over the last few years, you know, and they've suffered in the performance PC space as well with the attack from AMD. You know, their performance has gone a shot through the roof. So Intel are being attacked on numerous fronts, really. You know, this is just another way that Apple has probably gone, well, actually, we could do this better ourselves.
Yeah, I think that's probably the case, is that you've got, you know, Apple turn around and go, well, we make all these, we've created all the silicon for all the iPhones, for all the iPads, you know, for other bits and bobs that we're throwing in there as well. Why are we still outsourcing this to someone else? It then allows them to run the playbook by, you know, their own timelines, not be forced by, you know, we had all that delays from Intel with their processors a couple of years ago. That then put the entire PC industry, including Apple, on a back foot because they couldn't then launch the new generation of processors. You know, Apple's probably thinking, you know what, we'll just do it ourselves. I suspect what will happen is that the transition, they'll focus for the next year on developers, making sure that the apps are there. Obviously, that play with, we've got all the iPad apps, that will be a key factor there, and stuff. So they there's no argument of, oh, it doesn't work, the software doesn't work. And they've done a lot of stuff to translate on the fly and all those kind of things. And then in 2 or 3 years' time, because it's always the case, you know, look at Apple Maps, first couple of years, diabolically awful, and then everybody think, you know, slowly people are coming around to it or not. But it's a much better product now. And I suspect that will be the same case. So that by the time most people come to upgrade their Mac in 3 or 4 years' time, it will just be a given that it's Apple Silicon, rather than thinking, oh, why can't I get the Intel version of this?
Yeah, totally. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's a long-term game, isn't it? And, you know, there are, you know, I mentioned earlier the performance end of things. There's no reason why that couldn't transition to ARM-based chips in time. It's just that people... you know, in terms of when they're buying massive amounts of this equipment, they're going, well, you know, is that, you know, can I really trust that for the next 5 years or whatever? But that will be a different question in a few years' time. Yeah, absolutely.
So I've got one last question for each of you, the different questions. So, Dan, are we excited for September and what the new products will bring, the new software will bring for Apple, or are we kind of like, oh, well?
Well, I'm definitely excited about there being a ARM-based Mac, because I think, you know, having, and if that does come before the end of the year, that is, you know, thrilling to me, really, be able to take it out and about and you know, actually have a more iPad-like experience, but also with the sort of Mac keyboard. I think the new Apple Watch is going to be really interesting as well, because I think, you know, we talked about Apple, the battery life for the sleep tracking. I think that this time the Apple Watch could potentially be, you know, have much longer battery life, which would obviously make that make more sense as a feature. And that, you know, that would be quite compelling. But you know, we also believe that we're going to have a 5G iPhone, and obviously we haven't referenced that so far. But actually, you know, if Apple can propel 5G to a point that where people are really interested in it, then obviously that's going to kick things on as well.
And Chris, the final question for you is: you wrote a really interesting opinion piece about just about the state of Android, and if Apple copies off Android, who's Android going to copy off? What do you think we've kind of missed out on here, or what would you hope that they'll do beyond? You know, where's the industry take all the announcements? Where does it move on to from here?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because we've spoken a lot over the things that we've been talking about, how this stuff does just churn in circles, and that's always the case with these things. They spin around in circles. We've just been talking about the moving to Apple Silicon, and obviously we've seen Windows try to move itself onto a different type of platform away from Intel before. You know, the car key thing, we've seen it in apps before. We've seen those widgets and stuff. So obviously, you know, these things go in circles. And the point I was writing in my piece the other day is if Apple is now copying Android for some of its phone ideas, then who's Android going to copy off to come up with its next ideas? But the way that this always pans out is these things spin around in circles, and everyone said, oh, this is just copying this, this is just copying this. And then something fires out at like a shooting star and just becomes a trend. And then people will pick up on that and run away with that. Exactly where that comes from, I don't know. You probably have to go to a futurologist and ask exactly what that's going to be. But there are still some obvious things that Apple is doing really well that other people haven't managed to rival. iMessage is a good example of that. We're still not there with Google and Android with RCS messaging that's supposed to be coming along to rival that, but hasn't really got off the ground. Things like the way that the AirPods can seamlessly move between your devices and get smarter, thanks to one ecosystem with one universal sign-in for the whole lot. We're still not there with that on other platforms, and that's something, I mean, the fiddle that goes through connecting Bluetooth devices and stuff when you're using all sorts of things on different platforms, you know, these are pain points that still exist in other areas. And so I think there is still plenty to be done. It's just, you know, we come back to that same point often when talking about Apple, is how key the ecosystem is and how important it is to have an Apple ID that gives you access to a whole load of stuff when other platforms will want you to have a whole load of different IDs. If you're signing into a Windows computer and then signing into your Android phone and signing into your PlayStation, all these things, all of those things need different credentials and stuff. And that does mean there's always a slight breakdown between those different platforms.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. That's it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. Until next time, pip pip.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.